Hey there, this is the On Science podcast from NPR News. I'm Andrew Prince. This week on the podcast, we'll see what some scientists have to say about working the overnight shift. And the theme of Mathematics Awareness Month this year, unraveling complex systems. We'll find out about both a bit more later on. A year ago, an explosion rocked the Deepwater Horizon oil rig. It was drilling an exploratory well for BP some 40 miles off the Louisiana coast. Fire engulfed the platform, and 2 days later, the rig sank to the seafloor. 11 crew members were killed, 16 were injured, and the resulting gusher would last nearly 3 months and spill roughly 4 million barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. At the time, many along the Gulf Coast feared that BP oil would inundate the coastal wetlands that produce so much of the country's seafood. A year later, you can find oil in about half of the 1,000 miles of marsh and beach that were originally hit by the spill. In a moment, we'll hear why some efforts to study the spill's environmental impact have been delayed or kept secret. But first, NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports that the amount of oil still in the Gulf Coast marshes is surprising, even to the experts.
On this coastal marsh south of New Orleans, oil still saturates a 30-foot-wide stretch. Where hip-high grass should be, the oil has formed a hard, dark mat.
It hasn't weathered or degraded much since it came ashore in early June.
Scientist Scott Zangle has spent a lot of time in this remote area known as Bay Jimmy. He's a contractor for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, overseeing the marsh survey crews. He says lots of BP oil came ashore here and stayed.
It knocked down the vegetation, and it formed this tarry coat on top and trapped oil underneath.
Crews documented this oil for weeks, but it was September before one scientist dug into the matted grass.
But let me show you what it looks like underneath here.
Zangle digs down about 6 inches. His shovel reveals a thick layer of glistening oil.
It's kind of like a thin peanut butter type consistency.
The wind, rain, sun, and even waves can't get to it to break it down.
We just saw how bad it was. I don't think anyone had quite seen this before.
Biologists are so worried about birds getting oiled here, they've set up what they call scare cannons to keep them away. Scientists generally agree that after an oil spill, marshes fare best when they're left to recover on their own. Cleaning them usually does more harm than good. These marshes provide a nursery for shrimp, crabs, and fish, and protect New Orleans from storm surges. Even before the oil spill, they were rapidly disappearing. Zangle decided to use this strip of marsh to test a variety of cleanup methods to see if some technique could help save this marsh and other heavily oiled areas.
It's kind of like a mad science experiment.
He shows me plots where workers tried everything from vacuums to power washing to chemicals. Nothing worked. Then Zangle came up with an idea of raking the marsh with pitchforks to get the tarry plants to stand up, and then cutting them with a hedge clipper. That uncovers the gooey stuff scientists call mousse.
We tried to smear a lot of that mousse up onto the vegetation that we were raking up, so that when we cut it, we could remove all that material.
The plots where Zangle used this technique do look better than the others. The tarry mat is gone. The surface oil is weathering, and when he digs, the oozy layer is barely visible.
And also, compared to where we just were, you see a good bit more vegetation sprouting. Now, is it anywhere close to recovered or looking like the natural marsh behind this area? No.
Some scientists argue this area should be excavated and replaced with fabricated marsh. Zangle's the first to admit his work is risky.
Some of these treatments may still end up being more damaging in the long run. We just don't know. And we had to make a decision. You know, winter and early spring are the time to be in the marsh if you're going to do something.
First, manual crews started using the technique. Now heavy machines are mimicking the method. We watch as a massive long-arm excavator pulls a makeshift rake through the marsh. About a third of the 400 miles of Louisiana coastal wetlands hit with BP oil still show some visible signs. But less than 10 miles have enough oil to warrant such an aggressive cleanup. And in many once oily marshes, green plants are now sprouting. Still, scientists say BP oil is in this ecosystem for the long term. Tulane University oceanographer Brad Rosenheim says it's very important to tease out whether BP oil is behind bad things that happen to wildlife and plants in the future.
for instance, if a section of our wetlands disappears in the next few years. The natural question would be, well, was that because of the oil spill, or was that because of business as usual on the Louisiana coastline? And in order to answer that question, we obviously need a pretty good fingerprint of that oil. We need to monitor it through time.
He's been regularly sampling oil from the marshes in Bay Jimmy and from the beach on Grand Isle. He analyzes the samples to pinpoint chemical markers that will identify BP oil. Rosenheim says one thing already is clear. The oil will be in the beaches and marshes for decades to come. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
And that means we'll be studying the effects of the BP oil spill for decades to come. But some scientists say that so far, efforts to do just that have been delayed or kept secret. NPR's Christopher Joyce has that story.
Michael Crosby is a senior scientist at Florida's Moat Marine Laboratory. The Gulf of Mexico is his baby. He was thrilled last year when BP promised to give scientists $500 million to find out how the spill will affect marine life in the Gulf. 11 months later, he's still waiting to see the money.
In a word, it stalled.
Last year, BP did give $50 million to several research groups in the Gulf.
But the rest of the money has been just caught up in a quagmire of bureaucracy, politics, turf issues. Why the hell isn't that money out there? Why aren't we doing that? We have lost a year. We have literally lost a year. That's a huge gap.
The first year after the spill was the best chance to track the oil and its effect on fish, shellfish, birds, marshes, the whole complex web of marine life. Crosby says more scientists need to be out in the Gulf now.
Listen to those men and women that work on the water, and you'll hear them telling you they're seeing dazed crabs now that don't survive the transport, the massive miscarriages, fetuses, dead baby dolphins. Well, there's no hardcore data right now to make that link. And 10 years from now, you know, will they ever come back? Who knows?
Last year, BP and the Gulf states set about appointing a board of scientists to review research proposals and hand out the remaining $450 million. Crosby and other scientists believe the process got bogged down by politicians and officials from Gulf states trying to influence the membership of the board and how much of BP's money the Gulf states would get. Board director and biologist Rita Colwell says no, it wasn't politics, but a desire to get the best scientists that took so long. In any case, BP and the Gulf states finally signed a deal last month on the process for giving out the money. The next step is to ask scientists to submit research proposals. Reviewing those could take months more. In the meantime, BP has distributed the $50 million to scientists, and the government's National Science Foundation has also paid for Gulf expeditions. But Lisa Suotoni, a marine biologist with the environmental group Natural Resources Defense Council, says most of that work was about oil and not marine life.
What happened to the oil? What happened to the dispersants? What happened to the gases? But the biologists and ecologists haven't even laid their puzzle pieces out on the table yet. So there's no way of really knowing what the environmental harm was. The answers are slipping through our fingers. It is a very depressing subplot to the oil spill.
There's one other big source of money for studying the health of the Gulf, the Federal National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. But the scientists who take NOAA money can't openly discuss or publish their conclusions yet. That's because the government is preparing legal action against BP under the Natural Resources Damage Assessment Process. Christopher Delia is a Gulf researcher at Louisiana State University, and he says the NRDA clamps a lid of secrecy on research that many scientists find stifling.
It may end up in court. You can't just publish your data. You don't get involved in the kind of normal scientific discourse that we have. So it's a more constraining process. I don't think it works. I think it's a nightmare. I think the whole thing, it just grinds everything to a halt.
But NOAA officials point out that without NRDA, evidence against BP and its drilling partners could be compromised if published before a trial. They add that the data they pay scientists to gather does go on the NOAA website, only the scientists' interpretation of that data is secret. Eventually, all that information will be released and the world will know just what happened to the Gulf. But Don Bosch, a biologist with the University of Maryland who sat on the official Oil Spill Investigative Commission, says the damage from the spill is only a small part of what ails the Gulf.
Even in the worst case, the effects of this spill wouldn't have been as devastating as the tremendous loss of coastal wetlands, the
you know, the large dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico and all of those kinds of things.
Those assaults on the Gulf started long ago and are likely to continue long after the BP oil spill is just a statistic. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
There are some job requirements that seem so obvious you hardly need to point them out. For example, it doesn't say in the NPR manual that people we hear on air are not supposed to fall asleep when hosting a live news program. So it's not surprising people were outraged when they found out that some air traffic controllers fall asleep on the job. But working the overnight shift is tough, as NPR's Joe Palca explains.
Humans are not nocturnal. But modern society demands some people work at night. So, is there anything you can do to be certain that people will stay awake during the graveyard shift?
I usually say no when I get that question.
Torbjörn Åkerstedt is a sleep researcher at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm.
Night work is unphysiological. You can never make it as good as day work.
What Åkerstedt means by unphysiological is our bodies have an internal clock that's designed to keep us alert during the day and asleep at night. And that clock is set by the time the sun rises and sets. So any kind of night work is tough. But
there are several varieties of night work that are worse than other times.
Such as?
If you have very short rest periods between shifts.
That's because getting enough sleep before a night shift starts is important for staying up. But there's a problem.
If I give you 12 hours of sleep by day, you're still going to be impaired at 2 o'clock in the morning because your clock doesn't adjust.
Tom Roth is a sleep researcher at the Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit. So what can you do at 2 in the morning when your internal clock is telling you to sleep? Roth says a nap during your shift might help. But Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood has apparently ruled that out for air traffic controllers. Here's LaHood on Fox News Sunday.
On my watch, controllers will not be paid to take naps.
LaHood says the government's plan is to give controllers an extra hour off between shifts. Tom Roth is not convinced that's the way to go.
But I would rather see that hour of extra sleep at 2 to 4 in the morning when the person's really impaired in that hour.
Roth says anyone who's experienced jet lag knows what it feels like when your body is tugging at you to fall asleep. The difference is when you fly halfway around the globe, the light changes with you, and the light of the local daytime helps you shift your internal clock. You can shift your internal clock artificially with bright lights at night and dark curtains during the day, but it's tough and hard to maintain. It's also true that some people can handle jet lag or night shift work more easily than others.
You have people that are short sleeper, people that are long sleeper.
Maurice Ohayon is a sleep researcher at Stanford University. Not only do people vary on the amount of sleep they need, there are also differences in when they need their sleep. Larks tend to like to go to sleep early and get up early. For night owls, it's the opposite. But Ohayon says everyone will experience times when they get sleepy in the middle of the night.
Here is the biggest problem. We know that sleepiness is something that is taking you by surprise. You don't know when you are passing from sleepiness to sleep.
In other words, if you become excessively sleepy, you can fall asleep and not realize it.
You are always at risk to have a big episode of excessive sleepiness. The sleep can come at any moment. The danger is there.
So if you're always at risk for this, why don't we see more accidents or near misses in people who are doing critical jobs in the middle of the night?
We are lucky.
Not a particularly comforting thought, but it does mean it will take more than threats from angry politicians to keep people awake and vigilant in the middle of the night. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Birds and bees use math when they fly information or create a colony. It's called a complex system. Now, that term applies to just about anything that requires a lot of interaction to make things run smoothly. Power grids, the internet, financial markets, the cells in your body, schools of fish, any average kindergarten, and math is the basis. Unraveling complex systems is the theme of Mathematics Awareness Month. You might not have known it was Mathematics Awareness Month. It's an annual project of the Joint Policy Board for Mathematics, and Weekend Edition brought in their math guy, Keith Devlin, to describe complex systems to Scott Simon. They spoke last week on the program.
Good morning, Scott, and happy Mathematics Awareness Month to you.
You were the first person to say that to me.
Do you know, I'm shocked to hear that.
And I predict it might have to last me the month, too. But
it may well. Yeah.
That being noted, are complex systems the same as, is that another way of saying complicated?
In a sense, yeah. I mean, complicated systems is really just a generic term that in everyday language. The phrase complex systems really means when you've got a very large number of relatively simple systems, which you can specify using mathematics, interacting together. And we call it a complex system because the complexity defies prediction. You know, we're used to mathematics predicting things. You know, we know exactly when Halley's Comet is going to reappear in the sky. The army knows exactly where a mortar shell is going to land when it sends one off. That's using mathematics to predict with great precision what's going to happen. When you have these complex interacting systems, there's no way we can predict what's going to happen. We have to use mathematics in a different and a new way in order to apply it to complex systems.
And what's that way?
It really comes down to computer modelling. We build computer models of these systems. The mathematics we use to build the models, there's a lot of mathematics used. There's a lot of probability theory. There's a lot of statistics. Quite often there's differential equations, a lot of modern network theory. We put a whole bunch of mathematics together and we build computer models, and then we simulate what's going to happen. The simulation is never going to tell us what happens, but by playing with that simulation, changing one thing, seeing what happens when one power station goes off on a grid, seeing what might happen when there's an earthquake, we can come not to predict what will happen, but to have a much better overall holistic understanding of what's going to happen, so we can actually design them to minimise the likelihood that things go wrong, and also to prepare to do things when they do go wrong. And one thing that we've learned from running these simulations over many years now is that things will go wrong, and they'll go wrong in ways that no one has thought about before.
Mm. At the same time, Keith, the situation we've been seeing unfold in Japan suggests to a lot of people that maybe it's dangerous to have complex systems when the stakes are so high.
They are indeed dangerous, but we're in that world now. Some of the complex systems we have to live with. The internet is certainly one. The airline network, it's true that there's enormous complexity in the airline network. You know, one or two planes go out and then a whole country can be affected by them. But, you know, if we wanted to avoid those dangers, we'd have to say, well, we won't have airline networks, we won't have a power grid, we won't have the internet, we won't have any kind of an economy. It's just the world we live in.
Keith, are there complex systems out there we haven't been able to unravel? We don't understand?
The honest answer, Scott, is we have not been able to unravel any complex system. Oh. And I think one of the things we've learned, if we didn't already suspect it or know it, was that complex systems are inherently non-unravelable. The best you can do is gain a holistic understanding by running simulations. And that's the world we live in, and there's no other alternative to doing that, I think.
Keith Devlin, our math guy and Stanford University professor, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Scott. Bye-bye.
And that's it for the Science Podcast from NPR. We've got more from the Science Desk next week.